It's the lively art. Issues, interests, imagination.
This is David Edward Sims.
In conversation.
From the 1960s album Dizzy Goes Hollywood, Dizzy Gillespie, the great trumpeter, from an album of popular movie themes of the time. I would think that album is from about 1966, maybe 67, given the selection of songs. Dizzy Gillespie is one of those people that we don't hear enough of in jazz, and it's always good to kind of bring back his music. Welcome to David Edward Sims in Conversation on Radio DePaul. My very special guest today is Bob Moss, author of the newly published Vibes from the Screen, Getting Greater Enjoyment from Films. Mr. Moss has a very deep understanding of the language of film and a deep love for the medium. He's the leader of film study groups at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Northwestern University and an avid supporter of Chicago's many film venues and festivals. Welcome, Bob. It's such a pleasure to have you here this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And it's fun to talk about film, isn't it? Film is a wonderful medium.
Always.
It is. I have to say, when I got the opportunity to interview you today, it was kind of exciting for me because I've always been a film lover myself. And there are certain films I just adore and go back to as if they were old friends. And there are places in Chicago to see film that I think are just kind of sacred spaces, I think.
But there are. I mean, there are a lot of spaces that have just been around for years that no one even knows about.
How did you get involved in the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Northwestern? leading film study groups?
Well, when I left the bench, I came.
You were a judge.
I was a judge in Texas. And I came back up here, and I was doing continuing legal education for 7 years. And I enjoyed doing that and doing the education. My mother always told me I should have been a teacher. But and then one day I said, no, I'm going to do something for myself. So looking around, I found what's called OLLI. That's the abbreviation for the OSHA Institute. And I took some courses there for a semester, and then realized that as an alum of Northwestern, I could take some of their courses at a discount. And so I went and started taking courses at the film school, because that was my passion anyway. And at the time I was thinking, ooh, I'll become an online film critic. And mm-hmm. So, but I felt like I needed to know more of the nuances in order to do that. It's one thing to appreciate it. It's another thing to understand the nuances. So I took a bunch of film courses. Then I began self-education with the master classes from the Writers Guild, the Directors Guild, and all those type of things. And eventually decided to lead, because at OSHA everything is peer-led, lead one of the film classes, which was The Art of Watching Film, incidentally. But I used a textbook, and it was just too complicated for seniors. OSHA is for people 50 and up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was too complicated to really use. Though we did learn a lot, and I had a lot of great guest speakers of film people from Chicago, you know. But then from one grew another one, and then I got in contact with a gentleman by the name of Mark Cousins in Edinburgh, and he had a BBC series called Scene by Scene, where he interviewed people and had them identify a particular scene in a movie that they directed or acted in, and talk about what they thought they were trying to do and what they were trying to accomplish. And I found one of those online, but I couldn't find the rest. And so I tracked down his agent online. I wrote to him. The next morning, I got an email telling me, I have the only copy of the series. I'm too busy to copy it. I'll mail it to you. You'll convert it and copy it and send it back to me.
Wow. He trusted you.
Yeah, he sure did. And but it was a great series. And so I did. There were 24 sessions. And we converted that into a class. And then Mark had done a thing called The Story of Film, which was a 15-hour documentary series, and he also had a book that he'd followed up on that. And it went up through 2000. It was from the beginning of film through 2000. It's a wonderful series, and people ought to look for it, rent it, buy it, whatever. I mean, it just, when you see how film developed in each country, and how sometimes they built upon the other countries, sometimes they just use their own culture to build it. It helps you really understand what's going on. And he shows you some of the scenes, and then he shows you how scenes get repeated every 10, 15 years, you know, in different ways as the directors pay homage to their predecessors. And so that was a super thing. So we did a class on that, and it went real well. And in the meantime, I had started a class called Let's Talk About the Movies, which all it was everybody going to their local theater, seeing an assigned movie, and every 2 weeks we'd come back and talk about it.
So it's kind of like a book club.
Yeah, but I had two rules. One, you were not allowed to read a movie review before going to the film. You had to go in there totally open and receptive. And two, I never wanted to hear whether you liked it or not.
That's wonderful.
And it's irrelevant.
Yes.
Let's talk about the elements, how you were affected by them, and whatever.
I have to say, I personally have never been a big fan of criticism almost of any kind. I have to say, I shy away from film criticism. And even people that I respect very much as writers, like the late Roger Ebert, I never actually let him decide what I was going to see. That I always felt that I was often in conflict with film critics, and sometimes I would go and I would feel like I saw a completely different film than what they were talking about. And
right.
So I agree with you. I realize that a lot of people love film criticism, and I have to say I've never used it as a way of figuring out what I was going to watch.
No, but it's a good thing to use after you've seen the film.
Mm-hmm.
To help you evaluate, to think through, oh, that scene meant that, I missed that, you know, that type of thing.
Well, the book that you've written, Vibes from the Screen, Getting Greater Enjoyment from Films, that is a very comprehensive book. I have kind of gone through it cursorily. It's a very deep book, so unfortunately I didn't have the time to really go into it in depth. But I was quite impressed with how seriously you were approaching the language of film and how you were really explaining to people how to get the maximum enjoyment from film, not just looking at it as a story, but also as a medium, as a way of telling stories, a language. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I call it more an art because I liken it more to the artist or the sculptor that's molding something the way they're trying to express themselves.
Yes.
And yes, it's a medium. I mean, just like painting is a medium, etc. So it is a medium. But it's an art that's there to be appreciated. Now, that wasn't always so. Yeah.
What was it?
Well, initially, it was looked down on. And we had two groups of people, the elite, if you were, who went to the theater and the opera. And then we had the ones who went to the vaudeville centers and the little dump in the wall where they showed movies. And it stayed that way for about the first 30 years of film, you know, that were films were shown publicly, particularly in America. In Europe, it got accepted a lot faster than here. And then eventually the MoMA in New York, Museum of Modern Art, hired someone to catalog film, and they felt that they did that and started showing that they considered it an art, and they brought in samples for their members to see, it would spread, and it eventually did.
And people kind of had to learn how to look at film, didn't they? I remember reading about the one of the very early films where a train pulls into a station, and all the people in the theater thought a train was coming into the theater,
right,
and they ran out the door?
Yes, exactly. You know, they weren't used to the medium coming right at them. And that's one of the interesting things about film. It's two-dimensional, but people see it as three-dimensional.
Yes.
And they certainly
they
did.
Enter into it. You become part of it in
right.
some ways, if it's done correctly.
So that, you know, and no one's ever truly figured out why people's minds go that way.
It is interesting. Photography, of course, it's in some ways film is an extension of photography. It's photography plus time, in a way. And there is something about photography that we do perceive it as real somehow. And it does preserve moments that we see. It preserves people as we know them at a certain point in time. There is something very magical about the photograph, in a sense. And film is very much a magical medium, isn't it?
Well, you know, originally it was the magic lantern.
Yeah.
You know, so it is. You know, it just transforms you in a sense. But I say that in a sense because it's really how are you transforming yourself based on the stimuli you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned in my book, you go into a movie in an ugly mood, you've had a rough day. Well, in a sense, you got a couple of choices. You can stay with the ugly mood, which will taint the way you're looking at the movie, or you can let yourself be engulfed by the images and the sounds and let that ugly mood sort of go away for the time.
There are certain films for me that have always seemed like dream. Like you were experiencing a dream, and I would just kind of settle back and let them wash over me. I think of like Bernardo Bertolucci's film, The Last Tango in Paris, has a very dreamlike quality to it. And of course, Brando kind of helps to make that possible. That there's so many different kinds of film and so many different ways of perceiving it. We have musicals, we have dramas, we have all kinds of genres of film. You know, Chicago was very popular. I shouldn't say popular. It was pivotal in film history. That in the very early days of film, we had a burgeoning film industry here in Chicago that eventually, of course, moved out to California.
Right. Well, just last week, Geraldine Chaplin was here, and they had a ceremony honoring her father out at the old SNA studios.
Yes.
In Andersonville. So, and I think they're trying to remodel so that they're going to bring part of the old studio back.
Well, there's a lot of film in Chicago today, you know, that
right.
Here at DePaul, our digital cinema department is extremely popular
right.
with students, and Columbia and Northwestern and other
right.
Universities.
But there's a lot of TV made in Chicago, and there's quite a bit of film shot here.
So it's still alive.
Oh, yeah.
It is interesting bringing up Charlie Chaplin. You know, the Music Box Theater here in Chicago and the Gene Siskel Film Center particularly, they will occasionally run silent films with live musicians providing.
Music Box does it every week.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember being there when they were playing a Charlie Chaplin film. And it is interesting that as old as those films are, the people in the audience, and it was pretty much packed. It was a packed
right.
house. And those people were just laughing, they were rolling in the aisles laughing, and it is kind of amazing how those films, in some ways, they haven't really aged.
Well, they haven't aged, they've got the story, and they don't have sound in the sense that we know it. As you point out, it has music, and Chaplin was the first to send out a full score with his movies so that the
really?
Theaters could hire a small mm-hmm. orchestra and play it, okay? But they don't have sound. And there were many who, when sound first came out, said, oh, this is going to ruin movies. And their feeling was that with sound, actors wouldn't try as hard to convey the emotion and what they wanted to do, and they would let the dialogue do it for them. Directors wouldn't be thinking of as much creativity. Today, I don't know what the real answer is, you know, to make that comparison.
Well, films were very visual before sound. You know,
right.
And someone like Charlie Chaplin, he had to communicate his comedy through visual means.
Right.
And today, you know, when we look around at comedy, it's not nearly as visual as it used to be.
It's pure sound almost.
Yes, it's pretty much pure sound.
Yeah.
And so in a way, I guess you could say we go through styles of these things, but maybe the medium dictates to a certain extent. Certainly when sound came in, it opened up a lot of opportunities for great actors, and it brought in the film musical. Are you a fan of film musicals?
No.
No? How come?
I'm not a fan of live musicals. So, you know, film
musicals. They just don't do it for you.
No, they really don't. I mean, I can remember some of the old ones that I saw mm-hmm. that I enjoyed, but today it's just not my thing. So,
what kind of films do you enjoy today?
I enjoy the art house film, primarily French films, some Italian films. Those are my real oomph films. I mean, I guess I enjoy dramas primarily, something where you really see the human, I don't know the word I'm looking for, frailties, I guess, yeah.
Yes.
And get a feel, you know, for what's going on. I enjoy some suspense films, you know, certainly. Stuff that makes me think.
Yes.
Okay.
Do you like the special effects that are so dominant in today's
It depends how they're used, okay? You know, the whole idea of special effects was that it had to enhance the story. It had to help tell the story. Whether it was audio effects or visual effects, it needed to enhance the story. And when you get special effects for the sake of getting special effects and just exciting people, you've taken away from the film. So it depends what's done. Earlier this morning, I was watching a TED lecture someone had sent me, And it said, everything you hear in film is a lie. And he was demonstrating how the sounds are made and what they had to do in order to create the sounds. And it's a really interesting talk, and I recommend people to go find it. So, you know, it really, like, I have part of my book is on the curious case of Benjamin Button and the use of special effects and all the things they had to go through there. But that is a very clear case where what they did was to help the movie, was to help tell the story. It wasn't, you know, just, oh, let's have it out there, let's make a bunch of noise, bunch of spaceships flying loud.
So, bunch of superheroes.
Yeah, you know. One of the things, at the very beginning of Benjamin Button, there is a story of a couple whose son goes off to war, comes back and dies, and the guy is called upon to build a clock for the station. And when they start it, the clock is running backwards. Mm-hmm. But that whole scene is done with a sort of yellow tint to the picture, and very scratchy. So you think it's really an old movie, you know, barely make it. And if you listen to the director's cut, he said, well, we shot it, and then we went in and literally took a needle and scratched the film in order to create the effect. All right, that was done for a particular reason, to help the story go along. So special effects have their place. Certainly, there were lots of things we couldn't do live.
Yes.
We need special effects in order to be able to do them. So,
because our storytelling requires them, in a sense.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me about the kind of films that the people who take your film study groups, what kind of films do they tend to gravitate toward?
I think it's all over the place.
Really?
Yeah. Now, they don't have a choice in my group because I'm assigning the movie. But when they come back and tell me what they've seen, I mean, you know, we just had the Chicago International Film Festival, and I had a whole bunch of my people there. And there were 150 films in the festival, and I can tell you that my class collectively saw 100 of them.
Wow. All
right? Because they were that spread out in their choices of the film and the type of things they wanted, the musical, the comedy, whatever. So I don't know that the people in my class have any particular genre that they, you know, I could say the class loves. It's all individual taste.
Are films too violent today?
Some are. You know, again, it goes to what are they trying to do, who are they trying to appeal to. The ones who are trying to appeal to the young people have a lot more violence in them than the ones who really want to appeal to the older crowd.
Do you think the violence has become more prevalent?
Because it's out on the street?
Maybe, yes.
Yeah, really. And it's also, part of it's that, and the other part is what they imagine it used to be like. What did Elliot Ness face when he dealt with Al Capone and all that stuff? What was going on with the gangs in the beginning?
So we've become more realistic in the stories we want to see.
Right.
We're no longer, metaphor isn't doing it for us necessarily. It's not. A more poetic approach or a less direct approach is not necessarily where we are today.
It's funny you bring that up. I just wrote a blog this week.
Really?
On two films that I saw at the festival. One was The Daughter, and the other one was Cross Current, an Argentine movie and a Chinese movie. And they were both extremely metaphorical, very artistic in the way they were presented, and basically avant-garde. And the directors admitted that afterwards, and they said, I was trying to do something very different, and I was trying to, and you got to understand my people. This is the story of my people, my country. That was the problem. We don't know their country. And so most of us sitting there are looking at each other because we couldn't really interpret what they were saying. We knew there was something, You know, I saw something going on in the scene, and I said, that means something, but I'm not sure what. And so, unfortunately, that film, therefore, was not for global use. People in their country would understand it and either appreciate it or hate it if they were politically, you know, the other way. But other people don't. And so there was too much metaphorical use.
So the filmmaker really wasn't creating a film necessarily for people who weren't familiar with his culture.
That's right.
But some do, you know, yes. And when that happens, there is something magical about film in that you can feel like you're standing in the shoes of someone from another country.
Well, that's true. The whole thing about metaphors, though, is that most film goers aren't able to recognize that it's a metaphor, or aren't able to understand what the metaphor is trying to communicate to them. And that's one of the purposes of my book. If you know the things to look for, you'll eventually identify the metaphors and realize what it is, and then start thinking about the meaning. But that's the difficulty. Too many people just go plop themselves in a chair, say, entertain me, and either it does or it doesn't. And they don't really pay close attention to what's going on inside them as they watch. Vibes from the screen refers literally to that. Light is energy. It bounces off the screen back at the person and causes both a mental and a visceral reaction. Sound causes a mental and a visceral reaction. It's the vibes we're getting from the screen and the speakers, technically, but you know, that guide us through a movie. And then you add in what's inside of us, our perception, our memory of the past, our ability to remember what happened 10 scenes ago, that type of thing.
I want to remind everyone that you're listening to David Edward Sims in Conversation on Radio DePaul. And my very special guest today is Bob Moss, author of the newly published Vibes from the Screen, Getting Greater Enjoyment from Films. Tell me a bit about that book, that it's a very comprehensive book. I think it's the layperson who reads it will certainly be extremely well prepared to watch film.
Well, it's written for the layperson. It is not a textbook. It's not written aimed at students. I think students can gain from it, film students.
Oh, I certainly would
agree. But it's not aimed at them. It's aimed at the average moviegoer who cares about film and wants to know a little more. And so that's the depth of it. It's written in a conversational style. And I did that on purpose, too, trying to avoid the textbook feel. And it's a beginner's guide.
You talk about 7 tips for getting more enjoyment from watching movies. And a lot of them have to do with being more observant about, being more actively observant watching film, not necessarily just letting it go by and waiting just for plot developments, that you're really talking about analyzing the music and the sounds and light and shadows and camera angles.
Right. That's right. You have to look at everything that's on the screen at one time. That's why I always tell people, don't sit up front. Always sit at the back where you can see the entire screen and take in all the little things in the corners, because those are going to be tips to what's coming, what's happening, etc. But most people don't even, you ask them about the music after the film and they go, yeah, I think I heard some music.
They don't notice.
They don't notice the music. And yet the music is there as part of the story. It may be music, but it also, you might have to know the words to the song to understand it was communicating something. Or the music is building a mood. Sometimes all the music is doing is taking you from one scene to another. It's just a conveyance. But there are different reasons for the music to be there. And music is very carefully chosen. In her latest movie, which is the first one she directed, and now I can't remember the name of it, but Natalie Portman had a movie about a month ago or so. And she was asked what was the most difficult part of directing. And she said, the music. And they said, why? And she says, well, all the time I was writing and planning the movie, I had the music in mind. I was playing it, had it perfectly. And then she says, I finished a movie. I went to lay the music on top. It didn't go. It didn't convey what was happening on the screen. And so she had to go back and redo the music, soften it, and whatever. People don't realize that the music is added after the movie is completed. And even when there is a composer of a score, they don't begin writing the score until they've seen the entire movie.
They have to edit it first, I guess.
No. They see the movie as shot, okay? Then while the editor is editing, the musicians are composing the score, then a music editor comes in and begins matching the other editing.
Really?
And then they eventually go together. But the score is just give it to me from the entire movie. And one of the things that happens with the score is it's not always in the same order as the movie ends up. Because in the course of editing, an editor may decide to take a scene that looked like it was going to come later and move it up front because he or she feels like it conveys the story in a stronger manner. So, yeah, all that stuff is really intricate. And I don't go into very much of that in the book because, again, I wasn't trying to get that much into the technical stuff. I was trying to get more into what's going on in the filmmaker's mind. And in the filmmaker, I'm not just talking about director. I'm talking about the editor, the cinematographer, the actor, the scriptwriter, all the people involved in filmmaking. What is each one of them thinking as they are putting the movie together? What is it they want to accomplish? And very often, they don't match. And then it's the director's duty to pull the ones that don't match, put it together in a manner that they eventually want. So,
because the director is the primary storyteller in that sense. He or she is the person responsible for really telling that story ultimately.
Yes.
I want to talk about, you were talking about the screen, and I do realize that a lot of people today watch their films not on screens. They watch them on television. They watch them on computers. Some are even watching them on their phones. And so they're not seeing the reflected light of a projected image. They're looking right into the light source. And they're looking at these films often rather small. Do you think people are losing some of the film experience by doing that, or are they just doing it the way that they...
No, I don't think it. I know it.
Really?
I mean, any filmmaker will tell you that if you watch it on a small screen, you're missing something because they didn't shoot the film for a small screen. And when you reduce it, you're going to miss the nuances in the lighting, in little things that are in the mise-en-scene, in the corners, on the table or whatever. You're not going to be able to get the full reflection of the actor's emotions and whatever. And I haven't met a filmmaker yet that doesn't hate the idea of people watching their films on small screens. James Cameron said, you know, I can't stop them. That's what they're going to do. You know, I'm going to sell the movie. But he says the smallest screen I use when I'm making the movie is a 50-inch monitor right
really?
There on the set.
Wow.
That's what I'm looking at because today directors aren't sitting next to the camera. They're sitting in front of a monitor seeing exactly what the audience is going to see, and that's how they decide the angles and stuff. But he says that's the smallest. Spike Lee thinks even that's a little small. He thinks it ought to be bigger. So they're against it. Is the change coming? Obviously. With Amazon and Netflix and Vimeo and Hulu and all the rest of them helping to fund movies and put movies together, wanting them for the cable television or for the streaming, filmmakers are going to have to adjust and start making their films to fit on small screens and think about how they can convey the same message. That's going to go back, though, I think, to your special effects question, because I don't think they can do it live. I think they're going to have to apply special effects in order to accomplish it. But that technology isn't there yet, but it's coming. But filmmakers are going to if they're going to accept that kind of money, they're going to have to change the way they think about how they put the movie together.
Will they have to follow more of a television aesthetic? In a sense, I mean, television was designed for that.
Yes.
And so you have these tight close-ups, and you have maybe one or two cameras, and there's a certain form of storytelling that we see in television. Although television today is getting more cinematic, isn't it?
Well, it is, but I think that the movie makers are going to have to go back to the old Playhouse 90 days. When, you know,
interesting, yes.
And because that's where you saw the emotion, saw the camera moving. It had things on the table. It was conveying a message, but how did they do it? So I think they're going to have to go back and look at those and use that as their model for building upon.
And Playhouse 90 for our younger listeners who might not know, this is an early...
Playhouse 90 was an early series with plays. I mean, that's why it was called Playhouse 90. Usually, I think they were 90 minutes long and had all the top actors of the day in them.
And it was broadcast in black and white in early TV.
Right.
And it was, you know, early TV had a lot of very high art on it. It was
yeah.
actually quite a rather dignified medium in many ways at the beginning. How about the... I want to get back to the book again. That your reason... Why would someone want to buy your book? How is it going to help them? How is it going to deepen their experience?
Well, my theory is that if you understand the elements of filmmaking and why lights are used a different way, why a particular color is used. Vittorio Storaro, for example, came up with a whole list and said, this color means this, this color means that, and down the line. And most cinematographers have similar views. They may not agree with him on what each color means, but they all have a color representing something. So if you understand that, you'll understand the message you're getting. You feel the lighting and you see a close-up. Well, the close-up's for two reasons. It either says, hey, pay attention, or it says, be here in the scene with me. Don't be an observer. If you're further back, you know you're an observer. Also helps you see whose point of view. So if you know whose point of view that you're looking at the story from, that affects the way you do it. So that's my initial belief. And so then I say, if you get that down, and then you learn to look for the underlying themes. And so that's not just the overall story. What are the little things that are happening between the people? You're going to get more again, more meaning. And the more meaning you can get, the more enjoyable it is.
So you're really asking people to use more subtlety when they want to look for subtlety,
right?
To not just think that just because they know what the basic plot of the film that they know everything that there is.
Exactly.
To know.
Well, you know, we were talking about music. Well, if you recognize that there is music and you recognize what the music is, you may realize, oh, there's a part of the story that's telling me something. So,
you ever feel like it's manipulating?
Well, every part of it is manipulating.
Yes, yeah,
you know,
true.
I don't question that. Yeah, it's all manipulation. One of my favorite films is Lone Star by John Sayles. That has 9 themes in the movie. It's a very complicated movie. But most people who see the movie for the first time will probably tell you 2 of the themes. Mm-hmm. And it's only until you rewatch and you learn how to look for it that it worked. The people in my classes, I grew from 25 people the first semester to 147 people last semester.
Wow. It's very successful.
Yeah, and I'm proud of that, but it's really I'm proud of them more than me. And they will tell you, they all thought they knew how to watch film. Obviously, at 50 years old, they 60 years old, they think they know how to watch
film. They've seen a lot of them.
And they will tell you to a person, they get more out of it. They have learned to look for the stuff, and now when they don't worry about did I like it or not, and look at the art in the way he shot it. Look at the cinematography. Oh, the sound was so special. They're just like they appreciate the brushstrokes in a painting, the curves in a sculpture. They're doing that in a film too. And so they are getting so much more out of it. And so that's what people are going to get. If they buy my book and read it, as I said, it's a simple thing. Number one, they'll also pick up some great little tips of how people like Meryl Streep and Spielberg and Hitchcock think about what they're doing. And they'll learn the types of things to look for and say, and now they'll be able to, in the end, we're back to book reviews or movie reviews, they'll be able to do an analysis, to be critical.
Of their own.
That's right. Yeah.
So they'll become less dependent on the opinions of others.
Right.
Tell me about how you researched the book and how you decided to set it up. Did you use the experience of running these film study classes as kind of the way you set the book up?
Well, yes. I mean, the book came about because of the film study classes, because of the reaction of the people telling me what they were getting out of it. And so I took exactly what we did each session, outlined that, and then started writing the book off of it. In terms of researching, as a former lawyer, I used my legal research techniques, and I'm convinced that's what helped me do it. In looking for material, I mean, yes, I watched videos. I wrote down, second by second what was happening. I'm not going to tell you I read, but I looked at about 150 books, going through and pulling out segments. But the primary book was a 1916 book.
Really?
And that was by a Harvard psychologist by the name of Hugo Munsterberg. And Munsterberg back then came up with 6 processes at work when someone sat down to watch a movie. And it was those 6 processes: perception, attention, memory, imagination, suggestion, and emotion. And I use those as my core. And so as I went through each of the elements, the lighting, the sound, or whatever, I pointed out how those processes work with that element and how the filmmakers know it and use it.
And that's a very comprehensive approach. That's a very comprehensive list of... attributes.
Right.
So, and, do you ever feel like teaching the book and leaving off the film classes? Maybe there's another class there for you.
Starting in March.
Really?
Yeah, I'm taking my book, Munsterberg's book, Sidley Lumet's book, Making Movies, and combining them and doing a class on how to get more out of film.
Do you ever feel like doing a festival of your own, selecting the films?
And no.
No? No? Mm. You're more interested in just watching.
Yeah. The work that goes into putting a festival together is a bit much.
Tell me about your interest. First of all, you were saying that you were a judge in Texas.
Right.
Are you from Chicago originally, or are you from Texas originally?
Neither.
Neither? Where are you from?
I was born in Olney, Buckinghamshire, England.
Really?
And I came to the States and to Chicago when just a month shy of my 11th birthday. Grew up in Chicago and then moved to Texas a year after law school when my ex came home and said, "We're moving, I got a new job." Spent 30 years in Texas. And then retired and came back home.
So you find Chicago to be a great film town, I would imagine.
I've never thought of it that way, to be honest. I guess, as the movie buff that I am, I would probably prefer being in New York. because they have so much more in terms of the art films that they see.
Yes, that is true.
Okay.
And although sometimes New York can have so much that you just don't have time
to get
to.
Well, that's the problem. They have like 26 openings a week, and the New York Times finally decided they were not going to review every opening, and they narrowed down how many movies they review. But I'm just saying that it's there, and unfortunately, while we have some good theaters, we don't get as much. And we get a lot of stuff a lot later. So, you know, but yeah, Chicago is growing in the making of their own film, but it's more, it's not as much the independent style yet here.
Yes. It is considered a very photogenic city.
Right. Anyway. Yeah. There's a movie thing once a month called the Midwest Film Club. It's at the Century, I guess, the first Tuesday of every month. And they only show films made in the Midwest. Those are the only films they feature. And then they also have discussions from producers or other people in the film industry before the movie. So,
speaking of the Century, do you have favorite places to see film in Chicago? Are there certain places you just love to go?
I can't say there's places I love to go as much as there are places that had the movies I like.
You'd love to go to see, yes.
I grew up at the Music Box. I went to Blaine right across the street from the Music Box. And so I lived in the neighborhood, and so I would go to the Music Box every week for the kids' shows and stuff. So, you know, it's always had a very special meaning for me. The Century has a lot of stuff I like, so as does the Siskel. I have not gotten into some of the film styles that the Facets has, but they have some great film.
Yes,
okay.
They do.
But they have some more of the, they and the University of Chicago have more of the avant-garde than I'm used to, and I'm slowly getting into that. It's hard finding time to go to it. I see three new movies a week.
Really?
Plus what I watch on TV and streaming. So, you know, there's only so much time that I can do. I mean, but I love, you know, I'm looking at the sign for the Chicago Theater. You go in those old theaters and walk in and see the beautiful environment. And I remember that when it was only a single, I remember when the Century was a single theater, the entire building. And it had the balconies and stuff and had the beautiful gold things along the steps and the ornate stuff on the walls and the uptown, which was so special. And so, you know, I remember those type of theaters. God, I'm getting old.
They were palaces. They really were palaces.
That's right. Yes. And so, you know, I love walking into one of those places to see a film just to get the feel of the building. Today's theaters, to me, have no feel. They're very sterile.
Yes, they are.
And to me, going into most of the theaters is almost no better than sitting in my family room.
They're almost like rooms that are designed to go dark. You know,
right.
There's nothing there to...
Exactly, you know. And I sit at home. I have an 82-inch screen at home, once around. And so I can create whatever I need to watch a film because it's a smaller room, so the screen is big enough. So I can handle that. And so I don't get that much more of seeing the big screen, with exceptions, okay? Certainly, you go to the theaters that can still show a 35-millimeter film. That means something.
Yes.
And that's the other thing. A lot of people can't recognize when they're watching something shot on film as opposed to a digital movie.
Yes, that is true.
And, you know, I just saw Moonlight, and they asked him how long it took him to shoot it. Well, it was less than a month for the entire movie. Well, that had to be digital. You couldn't do that on film. And
did you like the film? It's getting incredibly good reviews.
I enjoyed it. I need to see it again because I know I missed quite a bit of the artistic stuff they were doing.
I wanted to ask you about that because I always believed that if you really want to understand a film, you can't just see it once.
That's right. You can't. I mean, you can go in once and enjoy the film, but then you're not paying as close attention to the other things. Now, certainly I and my students have honed ourselves to be able to take a lot
more
in.
Yes, you're more sensitive than most.
But still, I still need two, sometimes three. And so when I see I go see films at the festival that I wouldn't normally have seen because I know they're coming out. All right, so why spend the money at the festival? But I do it because I want to have an idea of what to assign to my class. So yes. I want to see it up front. And then when I assign it, I go back and see it again that week and look for the other details and cover it. But yeah, I think you've got to watch a movie 2, 3 umpteen times, you know, to really get all the nuances. Remember, the director didn't see it just once. Not only did they reshoot it, but then the director went in and watched what they had shot, reorganized it, looked at the story, had a feel, the editor helped. They saw it several times before they created the meaning the way they wanted it. So why should you be expected to get all the meaning out in one shot?
And there are certain films that people tend to think of as old friends, too, that they go back to them again and again, and they buy them. Like, I think of a film like Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, which mm-hmm. so many people love and has been so important to, like, rock stars. And
right.
There is a magic to that film that you can never get tired of.
And sometimes, but as you say, sometimes they're just comfort films.
Yes,
you
that
know,
is true.
Like comfort food.
Yes.
You know. People laugh when I tell them Sleepless in Seattle is my comfort film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you would never imagine me liking that film. But there's just something about the film that's just real comfortable, real fun to watch, you know. So it goes, you know.
And then you talked a little bit about today's movie theaters as opposed to the great palaces of the past. How do you feel about the newer trends in film to make it a more high-end experience, like cocktails and food and, you know, luxury seating? And for example, like New City, you know, the New City has developed a much more upscale film experience, and or even IMAX, you know, this idea of kind of a full three-dimensional experience. How do you look at those?
Well, but each one of those things has a different purpose. Okay, IMAX was created for showing the outdoors primarily. I mean, that was the whole thing, to be able to take you on a plane, show the whole scene. Yes, or make you feel you're right in the middle. But it wasn't created, at the time it was created, it wasn't created for dialogue films.
Mm-hmm.
It's being used today, but again, it's being used today with the ones that use special effects. A
yes.
lot of special effects, okay. In terms of the theaters with the food and whatever, I can't stand having a waiter or waitress walking around while I'm watching a film. You know, I don't care how quiet they're trying to be. It disturbs me to have these people going around. I have no problem with people sitting there eating, just as, you know, they would if we were sitting together in their living room, but not with people serving the food and not with china. No, that drives me nuts. We had that in Dallas when I lived there several years ago, and it didn't go over well, and it's not going to go over well here. But having a theater where you can go pick up something in a plastic container, little cheese and fruit, and take a glass of wine in with you, I have no problem
with
that.
That.
The comfortable seats I find disturbing, because they take away from my attention.
Yes, they kind of keep you, they kind of lull you into this sleepy kind of situation.
You know, I'm just not.
They take away your sense of awareness.
Right, yeah. And so I'm not a big fan. Now, there are a couple of theaters that have really comfortable seats, but they don't have the footrests that open up. Now, that I like, as opposed to the hard seat.
Yes.
You know, as much as I love the music box, the seats are extremely uncomfortable. But, you know, the places that have the small seats without the footrest, but yet, you know, you can be comfortable watching it, that I think is the right thing. So I appreciate that type of thing.
And it's interesting talking about food. I remember I've always been even more severe about those things than you are. I remember when originally the Siskel Film Center did not allow food in the theater. At all.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. And when they finally said, oh, you can have popcorn and you can have soda and you can have candy and things, I just hated it, because suddenly you were hearing crackling cellophane, and the floors were sticky, just like every other theater. And I just thought, this is awful. This is not.
Well, you know, I feel guilty when I'm eating popcorn. And that's well,
the,
a, that's
the
an
smell
American
of popcorn,
thing.
I have to say, it makes you feel like you're watching a movie.
Yeah, but that's an American thing.
Yes, I would imagine it is. I'm not a big popcorn fan, so I've never understood why people don't feel like they can see a movie unless they have a big box of popcorn in their lap. But what can you say?
You know, whatever.
It's been such a pleasure having you here today. I want to ask you about how our listeners can pick up a copy of your book. Your book is titled Vibes from the Screen, Getting Greater Enjoyment from Films.
Well, they can go to vibesfromthescreen.com, which both has the blog and a book purchase site. They can go to Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. They both have the paperback and the electronic versions. So those are the main places. I understand there were several other bookstores that have it, but I can't tell you specifically.
Mm-hmm. Can people take your classes at the film study?
Only if they sign up for Ollie.
So that's the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute.
Now, if anybody wants to put together a movie group, a monthly movie group, I'm for hire to do, you know, 9 months a year. But no, they can't take the classes unless they're part of Ollie.
I see. But can they become part of Ollie?
Anybody can become part of Ollie that's over 50 years old. So
they should check it out.
Right, yeah.
Again, Mr. Moss, Bob Moss, author of Vibes from the Screen, Getting Greater Enjoyment from Films, thank you so much for being here today. It was such a pleasure talking with you about film.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
And next week, we're going to be talking about new classical music. I hope you can join us then. This is David Edward Sims coming at you from the best station in the nation, Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection. And until we meet again, may the soundtrack of your cinematic life be jazz.